We welcome in, as we do every Tuesday, our talented friend, author Colin Fleming, who has written, by my count, at least 8 books and more coming soon. Terrific books like Buried on the Beaches, Sam Cooke, Live at the Harlem Square Club, 1963, Scrooge, and so many more. Colin, welcome in.
Hey, how's it going, Kimball?
Outstanding. How is your day so far?
Oh, miserable as always. Dragging, though. Not very productive today. Tired.
Sorry to hear that. It's our birthday today. It's the 11th anniversary of the show. Would you like some cake?
Did you just have some?
No, we have no cake. We have nothing. Last year, we had a big party. We had a Bananas Foster and the whole thing. And today, it's like me and Carrie sitting around going, wow, another year. Cool.
You know, I'm not a big cake person, but I do make an exception for ice cream cake.
Oh,
is that
yeah.
still around? Is that still a thing?
Yeah. That's a thing. Oh, yeah. It's a thing around here. Definitely.
Oh, you've probably had that during your school days, now that you're an ex-teacher, but probably had many a cake.
I've had some cake,
Yeah, your peers, and sing, and you would regale them with your voice, and I know how that goes in the teacher's lounge. Are you jonesing for it, Kimball? You're missing the days, the bygone times?
No, because I'm still there, sort of, part-time. I'll be in tomorrow teaching, so.
Like, officially, or you just swing by? Are you that guy? Like, work at the Starbucks, keep coming back, like Dr. Barista?
I would be that guy, but, you know, they're paying me, so no, I'm going to go in and teach a theater class every couple of days. But I would be that guy, yes.
I see. Well, don't give in to the rage against that dying of the light, Kimball. I mean, once you go in the mind, it's a swift fall off the cliff, and I don't want you to go there. So hold on. Hold fast.
I'm doing my best. Hanging on each and every day here. Well, we got a lot to talk about today. Let's begin with a very interesting episode of the great radio series Quiet Please, from 1949, called Dark Gray Magic. First of all, I just love the main character's name, Meredith Barleycorn.
And his friend, Lumen.
Lumen and was it Boge?
Bodge. Such a dick.
Yeah.
He's like the worst person in any, or worst demon, but it's one of the few episodes of Quiet Please that's funny. That sounds mean. It sounds like they try to be funny and they're not. That's not true. Usually it's thoughtful. This is thoughtful and atmospheric and can be quite frightening. I think for the old-time radio shows, the five-parters from Johnny Dollar, Gunsmoke, and Quiet Please, they're the gold standards. They really hold up consistently. Not like where they have a few episodes like Suspense that qualify as art, but from show to show to show, these three are the best. So this time, Willis Cooper did something a little different. And so we have the main character. He's coming home, and he's phoning up his buddy, and he's going to talk to him the way friends do about trivial things, just nothing consequential, about what he did, what his commute home was like. He stopped at the bookstore, tripped over a cat, bought this book. And he has unwittingly brought this demon into his life. And he's telling his friend, Lumen, it's almost like yesterday was Bob Newhart's birthday, right? And he does the telephone routine, and it's like even reprised in that first sitcom, The Bob Newhart Show. So this is like a version of that from old-time radio before we get to the demon, Bodge. So he's talking to his friend, and this demon dude shows up, and he sucks. I mean,
oh, yes.
That's funny. I wonder if, like, now you'd be allowed, I think because it's so well-written, you would be able to. But some of the things that the demon wants to do for kicks, they're kind of wrong. I mean, they're wrong to even speak of.
Yeah, and on top of all that, he's a shapeshifter, which makes it even more annoying.
He does some shapeshifting, but you know what? I don't know. I know I'm not supposed to enjoy this like I do, but there's quite a bit of fat shaming in this episode. So he wants to do some voodoo. Bodge. I don't know why that makes me laugh so much. His name is Bodge, because it's a bit like Vag. I think it's bad. I think like it appeals to the 15-year-old inside of me. And he wants to do this voodoo routine, and he has this photo of Lumen, and he's going to stab him. He's like, I stabbed him right in his fat gut. He says it like 4 times. He's really into that, but none of the attempted evil that Bodge wants to get Meredith up to works. Meredith is just not a good recipient for this kind of knowledge. And so Baj wants to have Lumen jump off the Empire State Building. Like, ha-ha, funny suicide. And it ends up going in reverse, and he leaps up to the top, and he gets his whole career for $1,000 a week in Hollywood, and it's awesome. And then Meredith has to contend with Lumen's wife.
Yes,
who now
Dixie.
Is going to court him. And that's just, he levels with her at one point. He wants nothing to do with her. He says, well, you're really fat. Like, he doesn't even say it to be mean. He just says it. And I'm thinking, oh, dear, I don't know about this.
And then she tries to entice him with, of all things, liver and onions.
She makes the demon sick. And one of the things that makes this episode work so well from a humor standpoint is how quickly Baj answers. Now, you can create humor when you have someone say something clever without any gap. Like, they don't need to think of it. They just have it ready to go, but it's improvised in that moment. They've thought of it in that moment. So there's a lot of that quick repartee throughout this. And it's like the type of episode that if you listen to it again, you'll notice all these other things, this like sort of verbal wordplay that you wouldn't have picked up the first time. That these two actually kind of become allies is funny because of this burdensome presence of this large woman with her horrible recipes that she wants to make, and she's all over Meredith, and he's like, can't you just go and be with Lumen? She's like, I don't want to be with Lumen, honey. It's like, oh, this sucks for this guy. This isn't a good time. And then Baj bails, and finally he is able to shapeshift into a bug. And that, there's a lot of things wrong with this episode. That results in Meredith hitting this woman because he thinks that he is he's getting the bug, and he ends up clocking her.
It's very funny. Wonderful episode. Quiet Please, called Dark Gray Magic. Colin Fleming with us on Downtown. Let's talk hockey. 50 years ago this fall, the Summit Series, and we've talked about a little bit with you before, but for your money, one of the great moments in the history of hockey and sport.
I had pitched something on this because September 2nd, on Friday, I think it was the anniversary of the first game. And when you pitch something to editors sometimes, you're reliant on their knowledge, their ability to clock on and recognize if something is a good idea. So what I was saying was that this series, especially that first game, it changed hockey in the Western world and the perception of where the Western world stood as hockey powers more than anything that had ever happened before. It was the ultimate in taking your opponent not seriously enough. And this particular editor said, well, I think it just pales in comparison to the Miracle on Ice. But it really doesn't, because the Miracle on Ice, if you understand it, it was, and this is no discredit to that team, that was a fluke. That was a one-off. That was not like a changing of the guard. That wasn't like, oh, this other thing is going on the other side of the world, and these people are every bit the power that you are at this. And so first game starts. It's going to be an 8-game series. It's supposed to be a total laugher. And like every Hall of Famer, like minus Bobby Orr, who was hurt, was on that 72 Team Canada Summit Series squad. And they come out, and they score right away, and it's all laughs and smiles and mugging for the crowd, and then they score again, and oh, it's like the ice capades out here, right? Then things go in the opposite direction awfully fast because of a Soviet player named Valery Harlamov, who was there. I mean, he was maybe the best forward in the world at the time. And they end up drubbing that Canadian team game one. And it's like this national nightmare, because this is really important to Canadians. And now it's like this other nation, they've stolen our birthright. And so the series ends up being this like back and forth sort of like nail biter. And ultimately, like, Canada wins, but it's kind of weird because it's like aggregate all this stuff, and they had to score this goal late and all of that. And Paul Henderson, famous. But it was huge. It shifted the whole consciousness of the hockey world 50 years ago.
And I love the way they did it. The first four games were played in Canada, which made that opening game loss even more painful, and then the final four played in the Soviet Union.
Canadian teams in these best of, well, this isn't really a best on best series, but in something like this, and in best on best series, Canada Cups, for instance, they usually start slowly, and oftentimes they require a comeback within the series and comebacks within games. Like the 1987 Canada Cup is the perfect example. You have that three-game final. They drop the first game in overtime. And they have to come back in game three to win it. And so that was just like craziness all around. But these guys weren't in the same condition that the Soviet players were. But they also got exposed. For instance, Ken Dryden was not a suitable goaltender for a matchup with the Soviets, with all of the Soviets' lateral movement and his sort of dangling height. It wasn't an ideal way to stop the puck. Tony Esposito was much more successful than Dryden in this particular series, but Dryden was the man. Even at this early date, he was the man. He was like whoever you want to talk about later, like the guy you wanted to get, the big winner, the like Patrick Roy, if he'll show up for the series. So it really only Team Canada pulls it together when they go to the Soviet Union. But they were getting booed on Canadian ice here in North America, and Phil Esposito made this like famous speech that they were doing their best. It was more than hockey. And so if you would play that Miracle on Ice game again immediately after it was over, I think anyone on Team USA would tell you what the outcome probably would have been. This was evenly matched. I mean, these two countries, these nations, these hockey nations, are pretty comparable. And this was our first sort of glimpse of that.
And boy, of everybody who stood tall to finally pull it out for Team Canada, perhaps nobody more so than Phil Esposito down the stretch.
It's one of those resume builders for Esposito. I think he's become so underrated because of the Bobby Orr factor. People think he was just a product of Bobby Orr. But like I said, Orr was not playing in this series. He was around the team. He was hurt with a knee injury, of course. Phil Esposito was the best player on this team. This is one of the best teams. Now, it was kind of strange the way they did the roster building because they brought in all of these guys who were only going to suit up for a game, two games, three games. And it really, again, it was supposed to be like ice capades. And so there weren't like a ton of guys who played all eight games. Like Marcel Dion was there Buffalo? Gilbert Perreault. And he was well suited for this kind of game with the speed and everything like that. But he's not playing in all eight games. Phil Esposito is easily Team Canada's MVP. And so when people say he's just a product of Orr, you can look at this series and say that this guy was. Because think about it, he sets his records for scoring, Esposito, back in the NHL. They don't get a chance to last that long. They're gone in 1980-81 with Wayne Gretzky, before he even has his first 200-point season. So you got like 6, 7, 8 years of like, wow, Phil Esposito was so good. And then the 80s, not just Gretzky, but everyone else kind of like blew that away because of what that decade was. Well, and also what Wayne Gretzky was. But yeah, it was a huge sort of boost for his career laurels.
While we're talking sports, Colin, why is college football so good?
It wasn't good when I went to see BC play Rutgers on Saturday, but I left in time. I did it perfectly. There, BC was leading the entire time I was there. They weren't playing well, and then I learned on the tee coming back that they had managed to blow this game, embarrassing at home. But the thing that I college football is my favorite sport to watch, and I wonder if that's changing a bit because it is becoming even more money-driven,
right?
Super conferences and all that stuff. But there's something about like going out to a suburban place, a rural place, a leafy place, and seeing Gothic spires and hearing bands, and everyone is there drinking in a parking lot. And I really like that because you can take that back to a novel that I love so much, To Walk the Night from 1937, which has this like opening college football scene. And college football was the big sort of elephant in the room for football before like professional football was. And I like sort of that pageantry of it. I'll tell you something that I'm not supposed to like that I realized I did like when I was there on Saturday. And I don't like much in my life, but I'm looking at all these like college kids, right? And they're like, oh, we're so young and in shape and everything. And I'm like really in shape. So I'm looking at them thinking, in 20 years, many of you will not even be able to recognize each other. You'll just give up on fitness and you'll have more than half of your life left and you'll be a dump. So, I know that's not in the spirit of our discussion, but it still put a little bounce in my step as I walked up to the tippity top of the stadium.
Yeah, and I'm obviously biased in this because I'm broadcasting college football every weekend this time of year, but as much as I like it, I really love the level that Maine plays at with these FCS teams because the money is not quite as big a factor as it is. And so to me, it's a bit more pure even at that level, and probably more so if you go down to like the NESCAC when you get the Amhersts and the Wesleyans, the Colbys, Bates and Bowdens of the world where they truly are student athletes.
I'll go out to like a Harvard game each year. Mm. And it's like the same stadium that would have been contemporaneous with F. Scott Fitzgerald. And
right.
After he left Princeton, didn't graduate Princeton, he would obsessively send these letters to the coach, whoever the coach was, saying like, hey, you need to run this halfback option. It'll definitely work. Yale won't have a clue. And I like that spirit. I like that there's more range of play. There's more stylistic range of play from team to team. And there are schools that are known for like certain things. They produce offensive linemen or they produce like sort of classic dropback quarterbacks. You have these traditions that are endemic to these different spots. And there's just, there's more variability. There's more flavor. Like our society, this is bad. It becomes increasingly homogenized. And that can be if you walk through like Kenmore Square and look at like what Kenmore Square was even in the 90s or in the 70s or 80s, especially, oh, that's gone. Everything is just like sort of plasticine now. And if you follow like 1970s baseball, or you retroactively follow it, with the uniforms and the hairstyles and the attitudes of people and the Bill Lees and the Charles Finleys, there just was so much more personality and spirit. And it's easier to like. And college football retains some of that. And I think it's increasingly losing it because of the money. I mean, there's always been like shadiness with money in college football. But the super conferences and everything, it used to be cool that you had the Big East. And that the Big Ten was actually close to like 10 schools and like a weird school like Rutgers or whatever wasn't in it. And you just would have these matchups and you could have these upsets that would just be one team playing some ass backward style that was largely abandoned in 1949 is beating this other team with all of these guys who are going to go and play in the NFL. When the guys at the school who are pulling off the upset, they're all going to be like accountants in a year or two. I really like that, and storming the field and student sections. There's just more individualistic expression to college football to me.
I'm with you on all of that. Let's talk now about a couple of your works, including a new piece in Jazz Times on Thelonious Monk and his very first sessions recorded back in 1947.
One for your father-in-law.
Yes, indeed.
You spread the word. It's a big piece, like a 3,000-word piece. And it was one of the last pieces to go into this jazz book that I recently finished up called The Root of the Chord. And so you have the war is over and bebop is happening, and bebop was going to happen, and it was kind of pressed pause on before it got a chance to happen with the recording ban and all of that because of the wartime efforts. And so Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, they do their thing, and it's 100 beats per minute, and bop is just raging and flowing and fast and molten and all of that. Then you have Thelonious Monk, who turns up, and he's not really a bebopper, but he was classified that at the time. Bebop was seen as like this arty music. It was small band. It required a certain amount of virtuosity or a large amount of virtuosity. And Monk, while not necessarily a virtuoso, was writing things that completely defied classification. Like, if you talk about musical composers of the 20th century, there aren't many, if any, that threw quite the curveball to what was going on as Thelonious Monk as a writer. Players, yes, Jimi Hendrix with what he was doing with the guitar in 1967. But even before that, you had Jeff Beck, and you had these certain things, and the Kinks, and Dave Davies. There was nothing that prepared anyone for the approaches that Thelonious Monk started to take. And because he, like, was ready to go, he shows up 75 years ago for Blue Note, and he's just doing, like, the sessions of his life. I mean, it's really the best music he ever made.
In the piece, you say that Monk was a master absorber. What do you mean by that?
I think that anyone who is a top artist is unique in what they put forth. But you have to have absorbed everything that there was. Sometimes I'll say, and I'm not even like being flippant, to write well, you have to know everything. And that doesn't mean that you put everything in there. You're putting a very small amount of whatever everything is in there. But you're aware of what you're not putting in. And Thelonious Monk was that way as a writer, as a writer of music, that he was aware of. There's nothing in his music that suggests the Basie band, but he was completely aware of the Basie band, and he was completely aware of Louis Armstrong. And that doesn't mean that, like, it's a pushback. You're not saying, oh, they did this, now I'm going to make my counter move in this other direction. It's not that, but you're just cognizant of everything. And I think when you're cognizant of everything and you have your own direction, it's easier to hew to that direction. We've talked before about how you can be deterred so easily, like with Brian Wilson. He's talking to these guys who are professional classical musicians or professional studio musicians. He knows exactly what he wants to do, and he's this 20-something guy. It's the vision. And that probably wasn't actually hard for Brian Wilson. It probably wasn't actually hard for Thelonious Monk because of everything they knew about what had come before, what was happening around them, what was possible, and what they were doing. So people tried to do what Thelonious Monk was doing. And, like, Coltrane played with them. And Coltrane learned a lot playing with Monk. But if you listen to them together, Coltrane really doesn't belong in Monk's band. That's not, like, a super great fit for John Coltrane, despite, like, how jazz historians tried to spin that. But I think he was absorbing, Coltrane that is, in his own way, so that was going to be an invaluable kind of woodshopping experience for him, so later when he gets to A Love Supreme, and especially Ascension, that he's going to have his vision be able to be true to that. And I think that's part of, like, a Thelonious Monk sort of rub-off effect for Coltrane.
Check out the latest Jazz Times for Colin's piece on Thelonious Monk. Finally, the introduction to a new book you've got coming out soon called The Human Reader, Pain-Free Explorations of Life-Changing Literature. What's the theme of this new book, Colin?
It's going to be a bunch of my writings about literature, but with the idea that literature isn't something, even just from the very word, it's not something to be frightened of or intimidated by or to have anyone lord over you. And I think that's what often happens. People will not read because they think it's for this reading, literature, is for this mysterious shadow class of the smart people, of the intellectuals. And it's just not like that. So you kind of, like, put off, and then you have all of these, like, writers and would-be writers and academics who want to pull rank over people. They want this to be their thing. Whereas if something is great, the Dickens novel or Flaubert or whatever it is, it's actually written for you, whoever you are. It's not meant to go over your head. It's not like, oh, I don't have a degree in English, I won't get it. It really isn't like that. So what I am doing is looking at how writing functions, what makes it valuable, what makes these poems and stories and novels and writers that I'm discussing and all of these pieces worth people's time and attention, and how it can improve your life and improve your sense of humor and make you laugh and have fun and think better and talk better and feel smarter and be entertained more, because that's the point. And I always ask myself when I do anything, what is the point? And that doesn't sound like radical conceit, but it really is, because people rarely ask themselves that question, because if they did, they wouldn't do most of the things that they do, because there's no point. So the point of these books, these poems and these stories of all of that, it's for you. The reader is always more important than the writer. And that's just something that I feel like people don't want to, certain people don't want other people, namely readers, to know that. But it's for you. That person, the other side of the table, if I'm writing something, they're always more important than me. The whole endeavor is for them.
Yeah, and as you say, the best writers don't think of themselves first, and also don't tell readers what to think.
The introduction has this anecdote. When I was a freshman in college, like I'd come back from the game on Saturday, and I would work on my writing, whatever it was. Maybe I was writing a record review or something, and think, I'm like, I'm not Lester Bang, that type of thing. Kids in the hall, they thought that was strange, and they would end up like reading it, or they'd even read something back to me that I wrote, and they wouldn't understand a word of it, and go over their head. And I was so smug and pretentious and stupid, underline stupid, that I thought, plebeian, lowly Philistine, I write so well, you don't even get it. Most people who write are quite insecure. I mean, really, it's a subculture of broken freaks. They don't get over what I got over quickly. The whole point is so that they get it. That doesn't mean that you dumb it down for them. It means you find a way to make it clear, and you write on many levels so everyone can find their respective level or multiple levels at once. So that was something that I had to grow out of, but I'm always thinking about the person, that theoretical person on the other side of the table. And I'm not thinking like, oh, they need to speak seven languages and be a brain surgeon. I'm just thinking of like whomever. It could be anyone, but they're everything. It's for them. I mean, really, that's, if you're not writing for them, and you can be alone on an island, but it still is in there. You've written it so someone could have that if they were on the other side of the table. The whole point of writing.
And you certainly don't write to read your own work.
No, and that's, I mean, because there's like a joke in the introduction, like, imagine if I said this, like, sitting here just reading some of my, I so enjoy reading from come the Halloween season. I mean, that would be, that'd be like really weird. It's like that, there's this editor I had, and he was at Johns Hopkins, and he had this giant portrait of himself in his dining room. And like he ate, like he was widowed, and he just like ate with himself, but just like his portrait, so strange to me. And so I read my work so many times over, of course. And you could take anything I've ever written and say, "Why did you use this word here?" And I would have a lengthy explanation for you. I'm starting to document that kind of thing on the blog lately, because it wasn't random. There is nothing that's a caprice, but I'm not writing it so I can read it. That's good advice to a writer to say, hey, it needs to get you going and pump your blood and make you want to leap through walls as you're writing it and make you cry. You know that, like when Kirk Gibson hit the home run off Dennis Eckersley, going around first base, and he does that fist move? I do that when I've really written something that moves me. I actually do that at the desk. But I'm writing it for other people. And once I'm done with it, I'm done. I'm not going to be sitting there and like reading it later tonight, something that I wrote 4 years ago.
Colin's latest book is If You Brackets, Fabula, Fantasy, Effery, Hope. I urge you to also check out some of the other great work like Dark March, Stories for When the Rest of the World is Asleep, the amazing book on Sam Cooke, Live at the Harlem Square Club, 1963. And the new books that are coming soon. Colin, always a pleasure, my friend. We'll do it again next week.
Okay, sounds good.